From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today on The Exchange, your reaction to the inauguration of Democrat Joe Biden as the nation's new president and Kamala Harris as vice president. We'll look at what Biden said in his speech and some of the executive actions he's already taken after less than 24 hours in office. So listeners, it is your turn. What are your biggest concerns as the Biden administration takes over? How much have the events of the past 2 weeks changed your perspective on our country's future? And if you could offer one piece of advice to the new president, what would it be? Let us know. Email us. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 800-892-6477. We're talking with Chris Galdieri, professor of politics at St. Anselm College, who specializes in the presidency. And Chris, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here, Laura. Thank you.
And also with us, Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Wisconsin. And Lily, a big welcome to you, too. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on today.
Well, so both of you, what were your main takeaways after watching the inauguration overall? You know, yes, the speech, and we'll talk about that, but also just kind of the other sort of pomp and circumstance surrounding it. Chris, you first.
Sure. One of the things that really struck me is the contrast between the normal pageantry of an inauguration that we saw yesterday in comparison to the last two Wednesdays. The previous Wednesday, we had the second impeachment of Donald Trump, and that impeachment was in response to the insurrection and the attack on the United States Capitol during the electoral vote count on the previous Wednesday. And so I think there was almost something of a sort of mental whiplash going from all of the drama, the unprecedented, unforeseen drama of those previous 2 weeks, to what was, despite the absence of a crowd and the COVID protocols and the less populated Capitol stage, familiar rituals of the parade of former presidents and former vice presidents and the incoming president-elect and the vice president-elect. And I think there was just this sense that, oh, politics can be normal again, which I think it hasn't been for a long time.
That's really sharp, Chris, to look from Wednesday to Wednesday to Wednesday. And you're right. Two Wednesdays ago, we had this unprecedented attack on our Capitol building. And then the Wednesday after, we had an unprecedented second impeachment of a president. And then yesterday, Wednesday, we had this sort of somewhat normal inauguration, although, like you said, COVID protocols and security protocols made it feel a little different. How about you, Lily, your big takeaway from the sort of show that we saw yesterday?
And I mean, I would concur exactly with what Chris was saying, but I also, you also don't have the crowds that originally were told to sort of stay away because of COVID. And so there were the flags on the National Mall instead of having people. But then you have that sort of with the overlay of the National Guard presence that came in following the events of January 6th. And how essentially locked down and sort of structurally limited the green zone of Washington, D.C. was, so that there weren't the people who would have been present in some form were it not for either COVID or the events of January 6th.
Yeah, and that pageantry, Lily, of the inaugural parade, where the president and the first lady and the vice president and now the first gentleman, they walk along Pennsylvania Avenue. Everybody's dressed in their best. The people cheer. They wave flags. I mean, we kind of missed some of that, didn't we, Lily?
And I've been there for an inauguration, and there is the sort of days that lead up to it. There are also events that lead up to it with celebrations, and what you had instead were the events that transpired the night before on the National Mall at the Reflecting Pool, memorializing the 400,000 Americans who have died from COVID. So it's just a, it was just a really different inauguration in so many ways. And again, these were events where the people, the Americans, would come to celebrate the new president. And that, you know, that that has a long history in the United States. And essentially, the people were not there.
Well, the choices any inauguration planning team makes says a lot about the image they want to present, the singers, the prayers. I personally thought Lady Gaga did a great job with the national anthem. Let's talk about the poem, because we got an email from a listener, Margaret, who says, the highlight of the inauguration was the poem. Amanda Gorman's performance of her poem was the most inspiring moment for me. Amanda Gorman, for those who don't know, she's the former National Youth Poet Laureate and now the youngest ever inaugural poet. The title of her poem was The Hill We Climb, and I want to play a little bit from it.
While once we asked, how could we possibly prevail over catastrophe? Now we assert, how could catastrophe possibly prevail over us? We will not march back to what was, but move to what shall be, a country that is bruised, but whole, benevolent, but bold, fierce, and free. We will not be turned around or interrupted by intimidation, because we know our inaction and inertia will be the inheritance of the next generation. Our blunders become their burdens, but one thing is certain. If we merge mercy with might and might with right, then love becomes our legacy and change our children's birthright.
Again, that's Amanda Gorman, the former National Youth Poet Laureate, who read the poem at the inauguration yesterday. And Lily, your thoughts? You look at the intersection of culture and politics. How did you view the contribution, the inclusion of this young poet?
And again, this, you know, you can look at the entire sort of program of the inauguration and see the forefronting of diverse voices of so many different areas of America. But Amanda Gorman's poem and her reading of it and her poise and her amazing sort of inflection throughout the rendering of these words, I thought was, it was incredibly moving. And she was so sort of centered in the moment as well. And her words were echoed by the Catholic priest who led the invocation with regard to love becoming our legacy, where he centered his words around love. And so I think you do have, you know, you sort of had echoes throughout with regard to not only Amanda's poem, but also sort of the idea of what America is. And I think you also saw that with regard to President Biden's speech itself.
Well, and we're asking our listeners if they watched the inauguration, what they thought. So you can join us by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or with phone call 1-800-892-6477. Join us today in the exchange as we gauge your reaction to the inauguration. Now, whether you voted for President Biden or not, let's hear from you, your hopes and concerns for the next 4 years. And if you could give the new president one piece of advice, what would that be? Again, our number is 800-892-6477. And our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Chris and Lily, let's start out with some callers. And Dave's joining us from Winchester. Hi, Dave, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, folks. Well, what I hope is that, you know, there are a lot of conservatives feeling disenfranchised right now. And I'm not sure that they're wrong in this. But what I hope is that they will discover civil disobedience, because you get the most effective change through that, not through the political process, not through violence. But there's this professor named Erica Chanowith who's been studying this kind of thing, and she's discovered that over time, nonviolent movements have become more and more effective at affecting change through civil disobedience and stuff like that.
So that's what you're hoping for. The opposition, fine, Dave, but, you know, don't storm the Capitol.
Well, I mean, most of the stuff that went on at the Capitol was First Amendment stuff. There were a few people that did something violent, right? But most of the others were just exercising First Amendment rights. So that's okay, too, most of it. But the violent part was the wrong part.
Yeah. Oh, hang on, Dave. The rally with President Trump was probably First Amendment, but storming the Capitol with guns and ties that you tie people together with when you look like you want to kidnap them, that doesn't strike me as First Amendment.
Yeah, the violent part, again, like I said, that's questionable.
Okay. Well, thank you for calling in. And certainly, Chris Galdieri, you know, lots of calls for peace, for unity yesterday. What do you think?
Yeah, that was one of the overarching themes of the president's address. And it's very on brand for him. You know, throughout the speech, he was talking about, you know, lowering the temperature, ending the uncivil war between the parties and that sort of thing. And, you know, that's a really tall order. You know, it was one of the things that if you think back a dozen years or so that Barack Obama talked about when he was running for president, that he would not just that he would get things done in terms of policy, but that he would change the tone of Washington, that he, you know, and then even running for re-election, said, well, if I get reelected, the Republicans' fever will break and they'll be willing to come to the table with me and that sort of thing. And so, you know, I think he's got his work cut out for him. And I think he's probably fairly quickly going to, his administration is going to have to make a decision. So how much do we try to get cooperation from Republicans and how much do we take advantage of these majorities we have in the House and the Senate, narrow though they may be, to get things done quickly so we can, you know, try to avert midterm loss and all the other things that tend to happen in first terms.
Well, and everybody was expecting calls for unity in that inaugural speech. So let's just hear one of many references to unity from President Biden in his speech yesterday.
There's literally hundreds of ways to show that you're a resident here.
That is not the right cut. And
I didn't think that sounded
like that's
like
our Governor Chris Sununu, who, by the way, had his own reaction yesterday to the president's inauguration. Governor Sununu said, I congratulate President Biden and Vice President Harris on their inauguration. Look forward to the opening lines of communication with the president and his administration. Governor Sununu said, this is an incredibly important and uncertain time for our country, where polarization and divisions run deep. He said, I join the people of New Hampshire in rooting for the success of the United States of America under President Biden. So we accidentally played that clip of Sununu there, but it gave me a chance to give reaction from New Hampshire's governor. Here's an email from Chris who says, I have two hopes for the Biden administration. The first is to have an affordable, non-employer-based, single-payer healthcare option. The second is to have a higher minimum wage, perhaps $15 tied to inflation. Chris says these changes would open up people's opportunities to move within the job market and would help close the income gap. Lily, do you want to comment on the healthcare point that our emailer Chris makes? Certainly, Joe Biden was vice president when President Obama passed so-called Obamacare, which, despite repeated challenges, is still the law of the land.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, there's a lot of discussion with regard to reform of the Obamacare legislation. Obviously, we saw this on the campaign trail in 2016 as well, with regard to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And so you had the passage of Obamacare, and then you've had arguments for reforming and replacing it, or reforming it in terms of a variety of different means. And of course, the pandemic has exposed so many different ways where our healthcare system is fragmented and stratified and serves different people in different ways. And so I think that, you know, one of the issues that the Biden administration faces is that there are so many fires that need to be put out kind of immediately around the pandemic, that sort of moving with a, you know, sort of attention to a full reform of the healthcare program in the United States is probably not the top of the list, but it is connected also to some of the issues around, you know, sort of the vaccine and testing and masks and trying to grab a hold, as they have said, of the pandemic and trying to sort of move forward to defeat it.
What do you think, Chris? Other themes that you heard from the president yesterday? We talked about unity. We certainly heard him talk about COVID. What other big themes came out from that speech yesterday for you, Chris?
Well, I noticed that when he started his speech, he presented the fact of his inauguration, the fact of the inauguration taking place at all, even as a victory for American democracy. And, you know, that's not that different from the sort of boilerplate language you often hear in inaugural addresses, but he was making this 2 weeks after an attack on the Capitol that was intended to prevent the electoral vote from being counted and certified. And so I think, you know, one of the themes that we're going to see throughout this presidency is this idea of how can we renew, how can we improve American democracy. So that may take the form of a new Voting Rights Act, that may take the form of greater organizing by activists to try to reform voting laws and regulations at the state level. But it was just really striking to me that for the first time, and I've, you know, heard a fair number of these at this point in my life, that was not just sort of a rote nod in the direction of democracy, but it was, you know, discussing democracy as something that had been threatened very, very recently.
Well, and to that point, Chris, we got an email from Kathy who says, "I fear that the wounds of the last 4 years are so deep, individually and collectively, that we won't face them. We won't do the work that healing takes," Kathy says. "Instead, we will put on a Band-Aid, smile or grimace under our masks, and keep on babbling about, well, if we could all just get along." So, you know, some concern from Kathy that despite all the talk yesterday, Chris, we mm-hmm. won't be able to get through this. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's going to be a challenge for this administration because, you know, there are, you know, for instance, any number of federal and state investigations into Donald Trump himself, his finances, his family business, actions he's taken in office, things he is accused of doing before he took office, before he was ever a candidate for office even. And I think the administration does not want to look like it is trying to use the Department of Justice or trying to use the criminal or civil justice system to go after him specifically. On the other hand, I don't think there is any appetite for, you know, a pardon that would make, you know, all of those things go away or anything like that.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Just that I don't think the Biden administration wants to spend a whole lot of time specifically talking about Donald Trump.
His
name was notably absent from most of yesterday's proceedings. We sort of had this period where, you know, I think effectively his term ended when he got on the plane at Andrews Air Force Base.
Well, and let's try that clip again of President Biden, again, calling for unity in his speech. This was all throughout his inaugural address yesterday. Let's hear.
"And so today, at this time, in this place, let's start afresh, all of us. Let's begin to listen to one another again, hear one another, see one another, show respect to one another. Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire, destroying everything in its path. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war."
And President Biden also in his speech, Lily, talked about the political exhaustion that some Americans feel after a tumultuous 4 years in our politics. What do you think? Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for total war. And the president also called for dialing down the temperature in this country. How optimistic are you feeling about that, Lily?
Well, you know, it's very difficult because we are in this place where we are a polarized country around politics in so many ways. And sometimes it's about policy and sometimes it's just about, quote, the other team. And I think that's the difficulty here for not only the Biden administration, but for the elected officials from both the Democratic and Republican parties at the state, local, and national level is, you know, it's sort of not necessarily always about the fact that you are my opposite, you, I'm opposed to you, and therefore I hate you because you are a Democrat or because you are a Republican. And when Joe Biden got into politics, and again, think about how long he's been in politics, that, you know, it wasn't as acute in terms of this antipathy that people have for one another because they're not in the same party. And I think that that's part of what Biden is trying to lean into is that, you know, we can have disagreements about policy. We shouldn't have disagreements about why we're Americans.
Well, and the conservative columnist Lily George Will wrote a piece this morning about welcoming the calls for unity, but also saying it is very hard to dial down that temperature and overcome that sort of not just I disagree with you about tax policy or whatever, but I hate you. George Will said that's going to be hard given social media. And I wonder what you think, Lily.
I mean, I think that that's part of it is that we now have these political scientists who've been looking at how people are defining their identities according to their political parties in ways that really weren't the case before. And so it's really difficult to dislodge that because if that becomes your, you know, your sort of how you think about yourself and people who aren't in the same group as you are the opposition. And we can think about this as sports team fans as well, as we were talking about before the show, that becomes really difficult to dial that sort of antipathy down because this is who you are. And so we are in a place where that polarization has really seeped into so many aspects of our lives that it will take quite a move and not just on the president's part. This can't be something that is only on Joe Biden's shoulders.
Well, here's an email from Katie just about the overall sort of presentation aspect of the inauguration. Katie says, two thoughts. I hope that school children will be memorizing Amanda Gorman's poem the way we all had to memorize Robert Frost. Secondly, as an attendee at Clinton's second inaugural, Katie says, I hope all future inaugurations have a virtual element and learn from this one. Yesterday's inauguration, in particular last night's performance, hosted by Tom Hanks, was so much more inclusive and meaningful and communicated better messages than all the other balls and events combined. Katie, thank you for writing in. We'll take a lot more of your emails and phone calls after a short break, so stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
As a small business, we have always prioritized our underwriting for NHPR as one of the primary marketing investments that we make.
Jim Fitz, managing director of the Colony Group, a longtime business supporter of NHPR.
We find that our clients appreciate that support, and also we frequently hear that NHPR is where they first hear our name.
You can learn more on how to reach NHPR's statewide audience at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're looking at the inauguration yesterday of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and getting your reaction. How are you reflecting on this moment? What are your concerns as a new administration takes office? What are your hopes? And if you could give the new president one piece of advice, tell us what that would be. Send it in by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or call 800-892-6477. We're talking with Chris Galdieri, professor of politics at St. Anselm College, who specializes in the presidency, and Lily Gorin, professor of political science and global studies at Carroll University in Wisconsin. And right back to the phones, both of you. Katrina's calling from Bow. Hi, Katrina. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hello. Good morning. It's great to hear you. I wanted to call in because my husband, who's a former member of Congress, and I had the chance to actually attend the inauguration, and it was such a memorable, really highlight experience for both of us. We got in on Tuesday because we had to go early to comply with all the health protocols. And honestly, my first impression of D.C. was quite dystopian. You had massive presence of, you know, both National Guard and police and fences with concertina wire everywhere. And it was something of a ghost town, but a little bit of an intimidating ghost town. But then on Wednesday, the atmosphere just changed rather dramatically. The inauguration itself was very, very uplifting. We were sitting with members of Congress and former members of Congress, and what struck me was that both among sort of Republican former colleagues as well as Democratic former colleagues, there was this sense of unity. I mean, it sounds a bit corny perhaps to say, but there was this sense of relief, of turning a page, and a sincere desire to, you know, to find a way forward that is better than the path we have just been trotting. And I have to say, I didn't feel there was a single false note in the whole inauguration. I thought President Biden's speech was spot on. Obviously, the young poet laureate was extraordinary, and really everything, you know, Senator Blunt, Senator Klobuchar, all of the voices somehow hit the right note. So it was really quite uplifting.
Well, and Katrina, so wife of former New Hampshire Congressman Dick Sweat, as you mentioned, you were lucky to get a ticket. I heard they were in short supply. How extensive was the security screening that you had to go through? Just real quickly, Katrina, I'm interested in that because I heard that it was pretty extraordinary.
It was good, but not, I didn't think it was excessive. As I say, there was almost more focus on getting the health screening. So we had to get a COVID test there at the Capitol in the visitor center the day before. And then only once you got your clearance on that could you then go on inauguration day. You had to answer a brief health questionnaire, and then you got sort of a little bracelet that indicated you had passed the health tests. And above and beyond that, it was, you know, there was this massive security presence. But then once you were sort of inside, if you will, the green zone or the red zone, it was more normal security. They checked your bag. They wanded you. But nothing more than that. So it was not oppressive. There was one very interesting thing that happened, which I don't know if all of my Democratic friends who are listening will necessarily enjoy hearing this, but we had the opportunity to talk with, as I say, members on both sides, and both before and after the actual inauguration. And one thing that really struck me was one moderate Democrat who shall definitely remain nameless because I don't think they'd appreciate me sharing their name, but they said that they had mixed feelings about the fact that Democrats had retaken control of the Senate, because they said that, you know, they felt that the most challenging times that they had experienced service in Washington was when there was single party control, and there was some concern that single party control could lead to, you know, a resistance towards finding that common ground that I think we're all so eager for. So that was sort of surprising to me to hear shared very, you know, confidentially and obviously very much off the record. But I do think that it will take a mindset that doesn't sort of say, okay, now we've got one party control of all the levers of power, and so, you know, we're just going to go to town with that, because certainly the atmosphere was at the inauguration was one of unity and trying to find common ground.
Well, Katrina, I'm glad you called. And Chris Galdieri, she's asking a question that I wanted to ask you anyway. So that is, you know, obviously Democrats were thrilled when they narrowly took the U.S. Senate. But Katrina's right. Sometimes that can be tricky for a chief executive. You know, when you've got the control of all the bodies, House, Senate, and White House, sometimes, you know, it can get difficult to say no to members of your own party. So go ahead, Chris. What have we seen with this?
Yeah, I think, you know, the Biden administration, I think they're probably very happy with having control of both houses of Congress, particularly with regards to executive and judicial appointments. The fact that Democrats control the Senate means that they will not have another Merrick Garland situation where a nominee just gets ignored. You don't have to worry about nominees being held up or bottled up in committees and all the rest of it. If there is a Supreme Court vacancy this year or next year, they can ensure that that nominee will get a vote on the floor of the Senate. So from that perspective, you know, this is pretty much an unalloyed good thing for the Biden administration. In terms of legislation, you know, it probably raises expectations, but 50 seats plus the vice president is a very, very narrow margin. So if you are trying to get something done through, say, the reconciliation process that can't be filibustered, it has to be something that everybody from Bernie Sanders to Joe Manchin can agree on. If you are trying to pass something through the more normal legislative process, that means you need to get 10 Republicans at least on board with it. And that means making compromises and making deals that might not go over well with the House, might not go over well with the folks in the Democratic caucus in the Senate who are closer to the Bernie Sanders end of things. So I think, you know, in terms of legislating, they're going to have their work cut out for them.
Well, let's take another call. And this is Lou in Nashua. Hi, Lou. You're on The Exchange. Welcome. Go ahead.
Good morning. Just a quick comment, and that is that true reconciliation needs truth about what we wish to reconcile. You know, there has to be some agreement about the facts in contention or the issues about which we're still fighting. That's all.
This is a really good point, Lou. Thank you for calling. And Lily, President Biden himself mentioned this yesterday, the idea of truth, how important it is. And I appreciate Lou's point. How can you reconcile if we can't agree on what the facts are? So go ahead, Lily.
Yeah, I mean, you saw that in Biden's speech. I thought it was, in fact, as you note, interesting that he put a punctuation mark on, you know, sort of an understanding of what truth is. And also in that context, you know, what is it that Americans want as Americans? Who are we as Americans? And then just to follow that up, I watched the first press conference with the new press secretary, Jen Psaki, and she articulated that again and again in her opening remarks, that what she would be talking to all of the media about that was coming from the podium as the press secretary was something that she referred to as the truth and as facts. And so I think that the administration itself has a narrative that they are embedding with regard to this concept
about truth and facts and so forth. Well,
yeah.
And it's so interesting to me to be hearing from listeners this morning on this idea of what we mean by reconciliation, as Lou said, whether it's possible to overcome these divisions. I want to let listeners know that we on The Exchange are planning sort of an ongoing look at this idea of political division in the year ahead. For now, though, I want to share a couple emails on this topic from listeners. And again, it's great to hear from you. It's exchange@nhpr.org or the phone number 800-892-6477. So I'm going to read two. Here's Josh, who says, while there is an element of sports as politics that diminishes the reality, during the Trump administration, we were talking about issues like if this nation was going to discriminate against Muslims, against LGBTQ people, and what responsibilities we have to treat our fellow citizens justly. And finally, we're talking about an administration that utterly failed to protect its citizens from a deadly pandemic, Josh says. None of that is a game, nor with 400,000 dead, is it just politics. Josh says, I have a very hard time being kind to anyone with a Trump flag or a MAGA hat, if I'm very honest. So there's Josh. And then I have another one from several listeners who were not happy with the inauguration of President Biden yesterday. Here's Kenneth, who says the inauguration marks a sad milestone headed down a path to socialism, government-paid health care, Green New Deal, government-funded education, continuing handouts to all, open borders with voting and benefits for all illegals, Kenneth's words, not mine, and soon government-run industries and businesses, all without regard to the burgeoning national debt. So that's Kenneth. And then Lou says, 'tis a sad day come Inauguration Day. I will be hiding in wait until November 2024 when Trump can be our leader again. So there's just a reflection of, you know, where our listeners are at with this idea of unity and division. Chris Galdieri, any thoughts you have?
Yeah, I mean, this is the difficulty of achieving unity. It's you know, what do you actually mean by unity? How much unification does it require? I don't say that to be glib, but, you know, is it simply a matter of respectfully coexisting? Is it everybody getting on the same page? Is it drawing lines within which everybody stays because that's what we agree on? And as Lily mentioned earlier, you know, there is an awful lot of recent political science research that shows just how polarized Americans are and just how central to our senses of ourselves our political beliefs and our political affiliations are. And those things are pretty resistant to facts. Those things are pretty resistant to events for the most part. And so, you know, you can say all day long that Joe Biden's not a socialist. He beat the socialist who was running in the Democratic primaries against him quite handily. You know, he's not talking about single payer, government run healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. But if that is, you know, the thing that animates your identity, if that's the thing that keeps you paying attention to politics, you know, it's really tough to find common ground there.
That's interesting. So in response to Kenneth's email that, you know, we're going to have government run businesses, you're saying, Chris, actually the facts are that Joe Biden beat the socialist in the presidential primary, Bernie Sanders. But if people think that Joe Biden's ideas sound socialist, then that's just the way it is.
To those people, definitely. You know, think back to when we were debating the Affordable Care Act in 2009 and 2010 and how much, you know, time we spent talking about death panels that did not exist. But that was a huge part of the conversation about that bill in particular and healthcare reform generally. You know, even when our identities do, you know, run headlong into facts, you know, we just kind of, you know, reinterpret them in a way that keeps our beliefs alive. And, you know, if you think Joe Biden's a socialist and he doesn't do anything terribly socialist, well, that's because, you know, we stopped him, or that's because, you know, he just wasn't able to do it. He was defeated or whatever. And it's really tough to, you know, find common ground when everybody is viewing politics through that kind of a lens.
Well, here's another call. This is Joan in Elliott, Maine. Joan, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I'm speaking from a teacher's position, having taught for 35 years in Massachusetts and New Hampshire, only 2 years in New Hampshire, but also 2 years in Wimbledon, England, in a private American school. And my thought is that teachers need to think of teaching students how to think, not what to think. I heard a talk show the other day where someone called in and said their seven-year-old came home from school from first grade and said, we shouldn't build the wall. And this tells me that there are some teachers who, excuse me, could you turn that off? I'm just having my husband turn off the radio, sorry. And I feel like most teachers are Democrats, but I think we have to allow free speech and respect and encourage equal opportunity for trains of thought and lead the way. And I think teachers have a huge opportunity to open up free speech in the schools and themes that students write and all of that sort of thing, and realize that they need to maybe in high school present both sides or allow both sides to be spoken and not try to persuade students necessarily to one side or the other. I think the teachers have a responsibility to not take sides or maybe even let students know where they stand. And I love the idea that President Biden wants a coming together, and he's moderate, and I think that will tone down the temperature a bit.
Well, it's good to hear from you, Joan, and I think we are looking at doing a show about how young adults, how educators are sort of viewing the politics that we've been seeing recently and this idea of unity, division, where we stand from this moment forward. So thank you for calling in. We've taken a very short break, folks. And when we come back, a lot more of your emails. Also, I want to ask both our guests about how the new administration might use social media. Twitter was a favorite way for President Trump to communicate, so we'll ask about that. Also, the role of Republicans in this new position that they're in as the opposition party. We'll talk about that. Keep your calls coming in as well. It's 800-892-6477.
As a small business, we really like to support the community around us, and we feel that NHPR is a very important part of New Hampshire's community.
Lydia West of Goose Bay Lumber of Chichester is a proud NHPR underwriter.
Goose Bay is a really small business with very limited advertising dollars, but with NHPR, not only do we reach our customer base, it feels good to be able to support NHPR.
Join NHPR's growing community of underwriters at nhpr.org/underwrite.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, your reaction to Joe Biden's inauguration. If you watched the ceremony yesterday, what did you think? What are your hopes, your fears, concerns as a new White House settles in? And if you could offer the new president one little bit of advice, what would it be? Send it in by email to exchange@nhpr.org or by Facebook or by calling 800-892-6477. We're talking with two political science professors who watched the presidency, Chris Galdieri from St. Anselm College here in New Hampshire and Lily Gorin with Carroll University in Wisconsin. And Lily, I did want to ask you about Twitter. As most people know, that was a favorite way for President Trump to communicate both politics and policy. How much do you expect this president or this White House will engage with Americans on Twitter the way the last president did?
I don't know that anybody will use Twitter in the same way that President Trump, specifically President Trump, did, not even his administration. And so I think that what you probably will see is some engagement over social media, not just Twitter, but Instagram, Facebook, and so forth. But I don't think that the Biden administration will be using Twitter to announce policy the way that a lot of Donald Trump's sort of articulations on Twitter were about policy, his opinion, what he was fighting for. I do think you'll see probably more of a curated Twitter feed from the president and the vice president and the administration.
What about other types of social media, Lily? You know, Facebook, TikTok, gaming platforms. There's a lot of political conversation that doesn't just happen on, you know, Twitter, Facebook.
Yeah. And I do think that, you know, you will see probably some engagement. But again, TikTok is so brand new in terms of a platform. And I do think that the administration will be accessing, but I would say probably in a small C conservative way, a lot of these platforms to sort of reach out to the public. Again, this is a really interesting way where politicians, particularly presidents, can communicate directly with the people. And so, you know, not necessarily through a party, not necessarily through a press secretary, but I'm not necessarily sure that this is how Joe Biden himself wants to always be talking to the people the way that Donald Trump did.
I have lots of emails from listeners on this theme that the president kept hitting: reconciliation, unity. Here's an email from Nancy who says, I've been a moderate Republican most of my life until Trump. Have been a moderate independent for the past several years. Nancy says, I am so hopeful that our nation will start to heal and unify. I think President Biden's swearing in was the start, but wow, Nancy says, Amanda Gorman's poem and the delivery was the spark I believe will light the way. Nancy says, I know there is a tremendous amount of work and dedication needed for our government to work together and compromise. I hope they will, as we haven't seen that in many years. Our government needs to become an example again, says Nancy, and not a disappointment. I am hopeful we are on our way to do that. So that's from Nancy. Here's Jeff, who says, reconciliation sounds terrific, but from my standpoint, we've had a group of people in this country that has not been dealing with facts and reality on so many fronts. So it seems to me the ones that need to do the reconciling in our midst are those who have been routinely dealing with lies and untruths. Jeff says, because I'm trying to come up with facts and ideology that I can compromise on, and it's hard for me to find many places that I can give a bit. Where and how am I supposed to reconcile? So that's another one from Jeff. And then here's one more from Roland. While listening to President Biden's inauguration speech, Roland says, I found it refreshing that we now have a president that realizes he's speaking to all Americans and not just to his base, that he does it in a way that you know he's speaking to you and not down at you, and that he speaks to us using a respectful, calm, indoor voice rather than shouting with anger in his voice. Roland says, I look forward to our new president addressing real-life issues such as the pandemic, climate change, and racial equality. And thanks to all those people for writing. And to Roland's point, Chris Galdieri, you know, a president who speaks to all the people in Roland's words, and certainly Joe Biden said that yesterday. What is the role of Republicans now, Chris, now that they don't hold the White House anymore or the U.S. Senate?
Yeah, I think, Republicans need to figure out, you know, what is their role going to be during a Biden administration? Are they, you know, what is their approach going to be? And if you think back to the last time we had an incoming Democratic administration in 2009, congressional Republicans, decided on an approach of pretty much, you know, universal rejection of then President Obama's proposals, from the stimulus to healthcare to the environment to immigration to almost anything you can think of. When there were Republican votes in play, it was a very small number of them, and they, you know, played hardball in terms of, you know, what sorts of concessions and compromises they wanted for their votes. So, in terms of legislating, in terms of passing stuff, I think that, you know, Republicans need to figure out, are they happy with that approach? Do they think that approach will work for them in the 2022 midterms and lay groundwork for the 2024 presidential election? But above and beyond that, there's this question of, you know, you've got a congressional caucus where, you know, a majority of Republican House members voted to reject electoral votes from states that Biden won and Trump didn't, without any real evidence or grounds for doing so. You know, there were no clear indications of, you know, fraud or misbehavior or any of those other things that might possibly justify that. So I think, you know, other Republicans need to decide, is that the approach we're going to take? Is that going to be how we begin this new administration? Or are we going to, you know, acknowledge the reality of the election while at the same time, articulating our principles and voting accordingly?
Lily, how about you? What hints have you heard from various Republican leaders about how they might act in this new role?
I think you've got a couple things going on almost immediately that have impacted and are impacting how Republicans take up this this new role. And part of that is the topic we haven't even touched on at all is this impeachment trial in the Senate. And, you know, to some degree, whether or not the Republicans in the Senate will sort of be whipped into a position in opposition to vote to convict. And again, you have Republicans who broke from their party or from the majority of their party in the House and voted to impeach the president a week ago, the former president a week ago. And so I think what you're seeing to some degree are tensions within the Republican Party in among the elected officials, particularly at the national level, with regard to how they see themselves going forward. Are they going to stand as, you know, sort of the loyal opposition as a group? Are there different factions that are going to work with Biden or against Biden? And I still think that that is not crystallized as clear as it was, as Chris pointed out, at the beginning of the Obama administration.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the impeachment, Lily, because Chris, I did want to ask you, how will this sort of specter of an impeachment trial affect President Biden's ability to tackle all the challenges, especially the pandemic, which, you know, we just got to get out of this thing. I mean, it's been too long.
Yeah. You know, a lot of that comes down to decisions that the Senate makes about how to conduct the trial. I think I watched part of the press conference by the new press secretary last night, and she repeated the words, that's up to the Senate, that's up to the Congress. President Biden doesn't have a role in the impeachment trial. So many times she probably could have just made it an app on her phone and pressed that every time she was asked about it. You know, there are all sorts of different ways this could play out. Does the Senate want to be done with this? Do they just want to do a speedy trial? Does Trump want to mount a defense? If he wants to mount a defense, what does that look like? Are there going to be witnesses? Is there going to be evidence? And, you know, you could envision a Senate trial that takes up weeks of time that the Biden administration really can't afford. You know, the early months of a presidency are crucial to getting a running start and laying the groundwork for big legislation and big accomplishments. But on the other hand, you know, you've got to hold the trial at some point. And, you know, that may come down to, are there Republicans, enough Republicans who are open to conviction? Do Republicans just want to be done with it? Does Trump's behavior, now that he's out of office and living in Florida, does he do or say something really outrageous that inflames everybody? You know, I think there's a lot of unknowns there.
If
I were President Biden, I would much rather the Senate be busy confirming my nominees and judges and that sort of thing.
And getting some, you know, coronavirus relief and speeding up the vaccines and so forth. I'm glad you mentioned, Chris, though, how important the first couple months of a new administration are, because the media often focuses on first 100 days. We here on The Exchange will often do a show on the first 100 days of a new administration. So how important, Chris, is that really, those first 100 days?
It's absolutely crucial. If you know, think back to the presidents that we think of as having been successful, as having, you know, big legislative accomplishments to show for their time in office, very often those are presidents who either got those things done in the first year or so of their term, or who had previously gotten big things done earlier in their term. You know, if you want, as a new president, to staff your administration quickly, you want to put wins on the board in terms of legislation. That doesn't mean you have to pass healthcare reform in the first month, but you want to pass some stuff that you can have the president sign and say, look, folks, we're getting stuff done. You want to build a professional reputation within Washington as someone who can work with Congress, who can get things done, who is able to bargain successfully and do all the other things that, you know, a successful president does. And if you don't do those things, you run the risk of being, you know, one of those presidents who, you know, they might sign some legislation, they might get some stuff done, but they didn't drive it. They don't have, you know, big, you know, sweeping accomplishments to show for the end of their tenure.
Well, here's an email from Dennis who says, not sure what President Biden truly means by unity. Dennis says, I support his agenda, but it certainly doesn't seem to represent a middle ground compromise based on his first day acts and his past promises to more progressives of his own party. Does President Biden's definition of unity only mean the other party should not oppose his actions. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but Lily, what about those executive orders that were issued, you know, less than 24 hours into office? The Keystone Pipeline, Paris Accord, you know, the mask mandate, the Muslim travel ban, the border wall. You know, this was some very hot political stuff that Joe Biden flipped yesterday.
Yeah. And again, we've, you know, we've sort of seen this growing sort of experience on the first day in office for a new president to sign one or more executive orders. As time has gone on, there's been more and more to reverse a previous administration's policy in particular ways. And so we saw this with Donald Trump, and now we see it, you know, the reverse of what Trump did in terms of what Biden did yesterday. And part of it are, as you note, sort of some of these hot button issues that, you know, dominated the beginning of the Trump administration, like the, quote, Muslim ban, travel ban. But others are, you know, about facing the epidemic and the pandemic and, you know, sort of trying to move forward as much as possible with the power of the executive to, you know, as I think Ron Klain had said, the new chief of staff to the president, you know, get their arms around the pandemic and try to, you know, put everything into solving that problem.
Well, Heritage Action, a conservative group, yesterday said, as the Biden administration begins today, conservatives are prepared to fight back against the destructive policies of the far left. Biden's day one actions will make America less safe, less free, and less prosperous. So there we have a sense of, you know, some of the debates to come. And I guess just last question for you, Lily, please. What are you going to be watching for in terms of tone from this new administration in the next couple of days?
I mean, again, in the next couple of days, it is also about the relationship that Joe Biden has had with any number of high-level Republicans. And so I think we saw a little bit of that yesterday with regard to some of his interactions with Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, but also, you know, where he's putting the efforts. Is it about the pandemic and just moving into that zone? Or is it about other issues that, you know, might be more controversial and have to, you'd have to build a lot of sort of unity around moving kinds of legislation or ideas forward?
Especially with that very, very, very small margin in the U.S. Senate. All of you, we will talk again, but for now we have to go. Lily Gorin, thank you very much. It was nice having you on the show today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Lily Gorin, Professor of Political Science and Global Studies at Carroll University in Wisconsin. Chris Galdieri, always good to have you too. Thank you for your time.
Always glad to be here, Laura. Thank you.
That's Chris Galdieri, Professor of Politics at St. Anselm College. Today's show was produced by Jane Vaughn. Thanks everybody for being with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.